KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, one of the world's most famous and successful photographers, Annie Leibovitz, joins us. We'll talk with her about her work and her newest and most personal volume, A Photographer's Life, 1990 to 2005. She joins us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. It's the closest thing to who I am that I've ever done. That's how famed photographer Annie Leibovitz describes her newest collection of photographs of photographer's life, 1990 to 2005. A compilation of many of her personal portraits of some of the world's most celebrated men and women, the collection is also a portrait of her family and her longtime companion, Susan Sontag, as well as landscapes and photos of birth and death. It was, in fact, the death of author and culture critic Susan Sontag in December of 2004 that inspired this most recent collection, which began with Annie Leibovitz searching for photographs of Susan Sontag to put in a book intended for those who came to the memorial service. Annie Leibovitz is best known for her work in Vanity Fair, Vogue, and Rolling Stone. She was designated a living legend by the Library of Congress in 2000 and an officer of the French Order of Arts and Letters in 2002. Smithsonian Magazine named her one of the 35 innovators of our time in November of 2005, and her books include volumes of photographs published in 1983 and 1991, Olympic Portraits, Women, and American Music. And she joins us for this second hour forum. Good to have you here.
Good morning. Good morning.
You're putting all those photographs out in front of you so that you can see them with quick...
It's a thumbnail, but you know, it's such a big book. I can never really see them all at once. But it's sort of like my little blankie I carry around with me because it helps me if I can see the photographs to have something to talk about it.
Let's talk about the range, first of all. I mean, it's not only personal and familial, and I mean, you've got shots in here at Sarajevo, you've got shots in Rwanda, you've got all of these, of course, major celebrities and political figures. And in fact, first question I have to ask before we get into some of the personal stuff that's in here, anybody that you haven't shot that you want to shoot? You probably ask that frequently.
You know, I am asked that a lot. I mean, I've been doing this for, you know, over 30, I guess turning on 35 years now, and I really don't think about that so much anymore. I mean, it seems like things sort of fall into place and come along. I mean, that's one of the things about working for these magazines I've worked for all these years, Rolling Stone for 13 years, and now, of course, Vanity Fair and Vogue, is things seem to, things fall in place. I'm a working photographer, so there's enough work.
You don't need to invent it, or you don't need to seek it at this point in your life. And certainly you've got three kids, and that makes life
It's true. I mean, before I had the kids, it was the world was flat, and now it's round, and
it's the opposite of Tom Friedman.
No, I was telling you, the children, met me out here yesterday, and they're on New York time, so I've been up since 5 this morning. So
well, we'll try to keep you awake and keep
okay,
you alert here.
You.
And one good way to do that, I suspect, is by talking about the book and the conception of the book. The book begins, I just want to mention to listeners, with Susan Sontag in Petra, Jordan in 1994 and Wadi Rum, Jordan. And these are photographs that really, I mean, as you say in your introduction, you look at these photographs after somebody dies and they take on a whole different meaning. Mm-hmm. And there she is at what looks like a mausoleum. But you end with pictures in Venice and Arizona. Is there a schema to this?
Well, the beginning pictures is sort of like an overture. And the landscape, actually, that was Mark Holbourne's idea. He was he's one of the last of the great book people. He's a book editor who's worked on Avedon's books and Lucian Freud. He does art books. I was very happy that he met me in Rhinebeck, New York, where I had a set of barns and I was working on the edit. And I had literally a wall of the personal work and a wall of the assignment work. And I asked him to come over just to see if the two works could be merged together. But it was his idea. I mean, I don't think I could have done this because, you know, the landscape work is more, you know, I feel like a sort of a hobby inside my work in some way. And it's something that I'm very moved by. I'm a huge fan of Lynn Davis's landscape work, which is very, very emotional. So I'm sure she's inspired me. You know, when I'm at places doing location work, taking Polaroids or taking stills to decide where I'm going to shoot, sometimes I find that those places look better without people in them. And so I ended up acquiring accumulating a set of this landscape work. Anyway, it was Mark who took the landscape work and sort of made it the punctuation for the book, the periods, the commas. It was a way to get in to the book, a way to segue in different sections of the book, and a way to pull out. And they are places that have great meaning, you know, for me. Several trips to Venice with Susan. The Petra picture, that was a trip for the traveler.
Condé Nast.
Condé Nast, right.
Yeah. But, I mean, some of these landscapes, I thought the shot that you did of the Nile, for example, and the shot of Malecón in Havana were really quite stunning and remarkable. And yet, I mean, people don't know you as a landscape photographer. I think you say in this, at best, my studio photographs are graphic. I can always fall back on composition, is what you say in the book.
Well, I think you do see the pure graphic in the landscape. I think I've always loved looking, and I think horizon lines can be very captivating. And I actually started working for the Traveler just with the idea that I was hoping to do landscape work. And you know, there is a funny story in the introduction about trying to do work for them, and they ended up not really liking the work that much. I think they needed more. I think they sent me one place to do the greatest beaches in Costa Rica, and I took these stormy, pictures, and I brought them back, and they were like very upset because they said, "Wait a minute,
this is for travelers.
This is our beach issue. This is supposed to be sunny, you know." So anyway, it was a short relationship with them.
Yeah, some really terrific photographs came out of that. We were talking to Annie Leibovitz, who, by the way, studied here at the San Francisco Art Institute,
right.
We should mention.
I still have two sisters who live here, yeah. Susan and Paula. Paula's a lawyer. Susan's an artist, a sculptor.
There's also a local shot here of somebody from this World Organization, one of these women organizations, all painted up, some local color. There's even our governor up on the ski slopes in Sun Valley that's included in Looking Like King of the Mountain, which I guess in many ways he is. The personal photographs, though, are certainly what has gotten a lot of attention here, despite this amazing array of celebrated people. And you agonized over this, didn't you? I mean, bringing in pictures, for example, of Susan Sontag, who was your close companion and lover, and bringing in these pictures of her dying and so forth. Your father.
I didn't really agonize over the edit. I mean, when I put the book together that August a couple years ago, I it was actually, it was an amazing, moving moment. I mean, I went in the barn every morning, cried, and then started, piecing the work together. But just to look back and see that I even had these pictures, I was so, and I say this in the introduction, it definitely helped me through the grieving process itself. But I mean, I didn't even know I had these pictures. And I wouldn't have even looked for them if Susan, hadn't died and my father hadn't died.
Within 6 weeks, in fact.
Within 6 weeks. But I think what I agonized over, or really didn't really agonize, but actually needed to have a process about, was whether they should be published. And that was a whole other...
That's what I meant, yeah.
I know, but there is a difference. I mean, once I had done the work and worked with Mark Holborn to sort of combine the personal and the assignment, it just meant so much to me. I mean, it just was so strong. It was just so, powerful. And I really did the book as if I did the edit as if Susan was standing behind me, working with me on the edit. And it was, because she could be really pretty difficult. I remember in the 1970, 1990 book, there were a couple of pictures she did not want in that book, and she just stands her ground, and after a while, it's not worth arguing with her. It's like you take them out.
I also remember her book on photography quite well, sure. And there was that kind of almost an animus toward photography. I mean, the sense that one had in reading that book was that she thought photographers solidify an image or freeze an image in such a way that it takes life away from.
Well, I think that's what Regarding the Pain of Others is about. She changed her mind about, you know, a lot of these things. It was sort of an addendum to, you know, to On Photography. But, you know, when I met her, she was, you know, she knew who I was, and I certainly knew who she was. And, you know, it was pretty interesting ride, pretty interesting, great, you know, great time. I was very, very flattered that she was interested in me. And, you know, she said, when she talked about my work, she said, you know, you're good, but, you know, you could be better. And, you know, that was, she raised the bar, and it was.
She made you better?
I don't know if she, if I am better, but I think she made me explore so many other aspects of the work. And the Sarajevo trip was something that she definitely inspired. I mean, she came back from Sarajevo and.
That was when she put on Godot, wasn't it?
That's right. She directed Waiting for Godot, yeah.
And this became like an archaeological project. I want to talk about Sarajevo for a moment because there's some great photographs there. And you say, in fact, in your introduction, great photographs and great journalism don't seem to make a difference. No one seemed to care. I mean, you have this photograph, for example, of a bike
with
blood that was really very moving. But it brings that whole question of what can art do? What can really bring?
Well, that was the problem. Is that it wasn't that there weren't not great pictures, you know, coming back. It's just that you know, not much seemed to be, you know, there wasn't much concern about, you know, the situation there. It was from the international community, and you know, we see that with a lot of things that happen. Well, look what happened in our own country with, you know, Katrina. But
well, I thought you were going to say in Darfur today.
In Darfur today, yeah. Yes, of course.
But we'll talk about that for a moment, though. I mean, what the effect of your photography? I mean, because you think about that child running with napalm in Vietnam, it really did have an extraordinary effect, just that image on people with
Absolutely,
respect to
sure.
turning them around in the Vietnam War. So photography can.
It can, and I do so much, you know, still strongly believe in this still. I'm not a journalist, and I don't really, I'm not, but when you're in a war situation, I mean, stuff happens too fast to, you know, stuff just happens in front of you and unfolds in front of you. That picture of the bicycle with the blood smeared on the ground was really, you know, I was on my way to do a portrait of Miss Sarajevo, and the mortar fell and killed a young boy on the bike, and I just took that picture. I wasn't even, you know, you're not really thinking, you're just kind of moving.
Then there's that photograph in Rwanda too, which is in this collection.
I went with Susan's son David Reef to Rwanda. It was sort of after. It was a month or so after the actual initial massacres, but there was still a lot of evidence, like that photograph of the, you know, that sort of abstract image of the feet and the hands and blood, you know, climbing the walls.
Talking to Annie Leibovitz, her new book is Photographer's Life, 1990 to 2005. You talk about, in your introduction, you also talk about Richard Avedon, who I was actually quoting him recently because there was somebody doing an article on me, and he looked at me and he said, I see my reflection. You'll never quit working what you're doing. You're too driven. And with the photographer's eye, he said that, so I give a good deal of trust to it. But you say that he was a great communicator, and you distinguish yourself from that by saying, I observe. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I'm, you know, he, in his portrait work, when he's sort of alone, you know, you're never really alone, but when he was one-on-one with his subject, I observed a couple of his shootings. He barely looks through the lens itself. I mean, he's standing to the side of the camera and he's talking to the person and he's you know, and he's really, you know, communicating. He's having a real conversation. I my work really came from, you know, just, you know, I think I'm just learning to talk now, actually. But my work really came from watching things unfold, watching things happen. I you know, when I went to the school here at the San Francisco Art Institute, I was really taught the school of photography was really based on Robert Frank, Cartier-Bresson, and it was really like, it was personal street photography. It was, you would go out and watch something, you know, happen, and you felt, you took a photograph when you felt moved to taking, you know, moved to taking a picture, and it wasn't more or less on assignment. So it was, it's a different animal completely. And I'm sure that's why in a certain level I started to do more of the conceptual work, is to sort of create something going on so that I can then one more time observe and take the picture.
And how much do you have to do with creating the content in the portraits that you do?
Well, again, that conceptual work, in the conceptual work, that sort of came from doing the covers for Rolling Stone magazine. You know, suddenly you were face to face with your subject, or it was more or less like an appointment. You didn't really have the, you weren't really with him that long, and you were, you know, you had an appointment, and then they, you know, they would say, well, what do you want me to do? You know, and so I pretty much, started to think about things they could do. And I think that I really became very conscientious of what I was doing when I was asked by Life magazine to do a series of poets. And I remember shooting Robert Penn Warren, and I read all of their poetry. And it was the first time I really was trying to take the portrait as if you could, you know, as if it was one of their poems. And Robert Penn Warren had been writing about death, and popular theme right now, it seems like. But he was writing about death, and I actually went back to his house twice. The first time I took all the standard kinds of photographs that you would think you would take, you know, at his desk, you know, with his wife. And I, as I was leaving, pulling out, I saw him looking from his bedroom window at me and staring. And I asked if I could come back, you know, another day. And you know, I literally went back to that room, and it was a gray room. And I sat him on his bed and took this very simple portrait, him staring in, you know, into the camera. I'm not quite answering your question about who has these ideas, but they come from the subject. The idea is something about the subject. I mean, I'm never asking anyone to sort of jump in a pool for the sake of jumping in a pool. I'm always, you know, I think very carefully through, you know, what I'm doing. And the other thing is, no one ever does anything they don't want to do. And it's really, you know, I sometimes have two or three ideas, and, you know, you go in with two or three ideas and you try to sort of work with the person and see what they're interested in doing.
Do you know, I'm struck by, for example, you have a shot of Baryshnikov, and he's on Rob Bessemer, mm-hmm. in Cumberland Island, Georgia, actually on Bessemer's holding
held
him up.
Yeah.
And then you've got like Michael Jordan and Holly Hunter in TV screens.
In TV screens.
Where it would look like video screens. And then you've got Heidi Fleiss completely in black.
That's the Polaroid. That's the full, you know, the other thing you learn at the Art Institute is you see through the camera and you use the whole negative. So you're seeing, it's when you see the black around the edge of the
looks like a video screen, doesn't it?
Well, actually what you're seeing is the end of the negative. So I learned to compose the picture by using the whole negative, whether it's a square, you know, or a rectangle for the 35 millimeter, you're seeing the whole negative. And that's how I learned to work. So it's not a TV screen. It's I'm showing the whole Polaroid negative, which I the Mamiya Polaroid back. If you use it, you can get the whole square, and it's quite beautiful. The, you know, the 6.65 Polaroid film is beautiful. I used it for a long time. I found that my Polaroids were more interesting than what I did on film.
Actually, you say early on that you don't shoot that much film. I mean, you know, in terms of just taking pictures of family and having a camera with you the way so many photographers do. I mean, just taking shots all the time.
And what I was referring to with that is that when I did my first volume of work, my first stop, and looked back in 1990 and looked back at my work from 1970 to 1990, you saw at the beginning of that book, you saw a little bit of the reportage, personal work. I did a lot of that through 1970 to 1990. It was a continuation of my work from school. It trailed off, you know, from 1990 to 2005. I didn't shoot as much of it, but I think what was the big revelation is that when I sat down and started to look through the work to see what I had on Susan for this memorial book, I was surprised to see I had what I had, because I really hadn't stopped in the last 15 years. I really wasn't very conscious of taking those pictures. You know, I took them, you know, we'd be on a trip or, you know, my parents would come to visit or, you know, it would be a family gathering or, you know, it wasn't very, so actually what was so great about stopping now and looking back at this work, and I, because of these things, because of this moment of Susan's death and my father's death and the children being born, these pictures mean the most to me. And hence, you know, publishing them. I mean, I don't think it's so different from other people's lives. I mean, Susan happens to be a famous writer, was a famous writer, a famous person. But the events you see, you know, the love story, you know, the birth of children, the deaths. I mean, these are our lives. And I realize at this point in my life, I mean, I'm older now, you know, and this means so much to me. And I felt it was important to show this work.
Did you waver, though, about showing particularly some of the more personal and intimate things?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. It wasn't so much a wavering as it was a process about trying to, you know, make the decision. Let me put it this way. Any picture that in here that one might feel, you know, may want to question, like, why is this here? I had the same feelings. I had the very same feelings about whether the images should go in. And it was a process. I showed the book to my family and my friends, to Susan's friends.
Did David Reif see it?
He did not see it. I mean, we're not really talking, actually. Oh. David and I are not really talking. But Andrew Wiley, who is the executor of Susan's estate, is the closest thing representing Susan. And Susan's sister, Judith Cohen, who saw the book. And I had support from everyone. And it, to me, it wasn't the intimate pictures of my relationship with Susan that were the most difficult. The most difficult probably were the very last pictures of her in the hospital. Those are the ones
those
that...
Those were tough. Those are the ones tough that, to see. I mean, I'm talking as a viewer.
They were in and they were out and they were in and they were out. I was trying to make up my mind about it. And I actually talked to a psychiatrist who had... spent, you know, 5 years at Sloan Kettering helping people die, and she said, you know, Annie, these are very important pictures. You must publish them. I mean, this is part of, as much a part of life as being born. And she talked, you know, she convinced me that let it roll, let it go, and I did.
Talking to Annie Leibovitz, who, by the way, says in her book, as far as advice to young photographers, stay close to home. I'm going to open up our phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us. If you have a question or comment for Annie Leibovitz, we welcome your calls, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can join us now, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or you can email any thoughts or questions or comments you have. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Annie Leibovitz, who, by the way, will be part of the National Kidney Foundation's Literary Luncheon. And you can go to the website, nationalkidneyfoundation.org, and find out more about that. It's an annual literary luncheon that I am the MC of with Amy Tan and a very good crop of writers, including a couple of local people like Khaled Husseini this year and Brian Copeland, as well as the great novelist Edna O'Brien. We're talking this hour with Annie Leibovitz, and we're going to go right to your calls here forthwith. I just want to say one thing about the portraits in here. Mm-hmm. One that I found, I always hate to make these kind of, this was the most arresting or this was
That's
the most
all right.
engaging, but I'm going to do it anyway, was the portrait of William Burroughs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've had that response, but it was just,
mm-hmm.
It was just so extraordinary because you looked at, it was almost like looking at death in a way.
Yes. I mean, his head and his portrait looked like a skull almost. Actually, I was just talking to Patti Smith, who played at the opening at the Brooklyn Museum, and it was so sweet. She sort of blessed the show. And I said, Patti, can I give you a print of anything here? And she said, oh, I want that William Burroughs. You know, it's, you know, it, but it is, you know, and it was printed rather large. And I said, you want it? Well, what size? She's like, oh, I like it that size. It's so large. And I just said, no, Patti, no. But
you get any political flack, though? I mean, you know, here's a picture of Bush's whole cabinet. And here's, on the other hand, a picture of the Clintons and so forth. I mean, do people say things to you like partisan about photographing political figures of that stature?
Well, I think that it was, you know, it was a look back at these years, and I think it was kind of a heady thing to be in the, you know, in the cabinet room taking this group of people right after the Gulf War, and some of these photographs are sort of, again, they're sort of punctuation, they're sort of history. You're seeing where we were in history, and to be in that room. I tried to soften it a little bit by the pagination. I don't know if you saw it started with Michael Moore and his group of cameramen who were with him, and then it went to the Bush cabinet, and then I think it went to Ashcroft in a very kind of strange position, kind of awkward, and then it went right into Star Wars, you know, RTD2, and so I was trying to sort of in the book make this sort of statement in that respect. But I think it's an interesting picture. It's actually not even a good photograph, quite honestly. It's like it has this kind of so middle.
The cabinet photograph.
Yeah, the cabinet photograph. Sort of like the middle. You're sort of like riding the middle of the. You're riding on the fence here, because it's like if you like them, you can like the picture. If you don't like them, you can like the picture. I mean, because they can look sinister and they can look strong. I mean, it's. Yeah. That didn't answer your question at all.
No, it's adequate. Let me get to the callers here. And Holly, you're first up. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Michael. I love your show. Thank you so much for having Annie on today. Annie, hi.
Hi.
Hi, my name's Holly. And I just want to, I'm very nervous because I've been so inspired by you for as long as I can remember. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
I'm getting all choked up here. I've been a rock and roll photographer for about 13 years, and it was your stuff, your original live stuff that really, you know, compelled me, I think, back when I was a kid. I'm just wondering, in American Music, which is one of my favorite books, by the way, I love that. I keep looking at it over and over. You said something about how you much prefer to take pictures of musicians when they're not performing, like when they're performing is the least interesting time for you to, you know, shoot them. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, because to me that's the most inspiring time for me to shoot them. And then quickly, and I'll go off air here, is there any chance that you'll be exhibiting any of your old rock and roll photos? And then lastly, how do I get a portfolio review for you?
How do you get what? I'm sorry?
A portfolio review with you.
Well, I'm a working photographer. I have an office in New York, and we meet people all the time. So just, I'm listed in the phone book, just if you spell my name right, and just give us a call sometime.
In fact, your father was Samuel Leibovitz. I think, I may be wrong about this, maybe a listener can correct me, but I think John Stewart's real name is Samuel Leibovitz.
I think it's spelled
with a W,
with a W
rather
though.
Than a V.
That's
yeah.
right. That's
but
right.
I think that's his real name.
Yeah, you're Leibovitz.
Listen, as far as what, you know, when I talk about my music work for Rolling Stone, you know, I started working for Rolling Stone, I really came out of, my interest was really photography and not so much music. As I said, I was interested in the Robert Frank Cartier-Bresson school of work, and I brought that style of work to Rolling Stone. I was a kid when I started there, and what I meant by the performance work is, I mean, there really are rock and roll photographers who do like to photograph the performance, but you know, I was much more interested in the lifestyle and, you know, the downtime, you know, off the stage. And I think music is, like dance, it's very, very hard. You know, I don't think you can photograph it. It's it's very, very hard. And I think that something happens in a lot of stage work and a lot of stage photographs where you you have the memory of the music in your mind, and it's hard to take a good photograph. I remember that when I was really, really working hard, I wouldn't hear the music when I was taking pictures. And it would take going on the road. You'd have to do at least 3 or 4 concerts. And in those days, I mean,
you wouldn't hear the music, but it was still affecting your hearing, no doubt.
Right, you're still at the mercy of the lighting crew who was on various forms of stuff. And so, the lights would go on, off. Actually, I just recently, I had to photograph someone in concert. I tried to do that kind of work. I realized if I just left the lens set on one f-stop, one shutter speed, some of it would turn out instead of trying to change it every time.
Thank you, Holly, for the call, and good to hear from you. We'll hear from some more callers, and we'll go next to Oakland. Chris, morning.
Good morning. I ditto the high nervous factor. As a musician, I've had the chance to do a lot of work with the Mark Morris Dance Group, and I've seen the really remarkable photos that you took of the women of the company. And I was wondering if they've been published or if they'll ever be publicly available.
Hey, they're in the book.
Are they?
There's a couple in this volume.
And in fact, they end 1970, 1990. There's actually more images there. It was done for a program for the White Oak Dance Company that was Mark and Baryshnikov together. I don't know I think it's probably hard to find that program. There are a lot of pictures in the program. But there's not a thought right now of publishing more. But there are two in the book. There's a photograph, actually, it's quite beautiful, that Michael was describing of Baryshnikov being lifted. And I remembered it was a dance that Mark did for Misha, and it was quite beautiful because Misha couldn't jump the way he used to be able to jump, and his knees, were not in very good shape. And there was this beautiful movement he created where Rob Besser, this very tall, handsome dancer, picks Misha up and carries him across as if he could fly and dance like he did when he was a young boy. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful.
It's also a great shot of Bill T. Jones, as long as we're talking about
beautiful
shot.
No.
And as long as we're talking about handsome, your brother, Philip.
Oh, he's
what a good-looking guy.
Don't go there.
All right. Chris, thank you for the call. We'll go to more of your
dad
calls.
Too.
Elaine is joining us next. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. Hi, Michael and Annie. I'm very honored to talk with both of you. Annie, this was a while ago, and it may be vastly unimportant, but I have a little treasure that you may want. I took a snapshot of you and Susan outside of the stage door, this a number of years ago, after watching Ralph Fiennes in Hamlet. When you saw me pick up my little Minolta, and snap, you turned around. So I got a shot of you, Susan, talking intently to somebody, and the back of your head. And then I had the chutzpah to wait. You turned back around, and I got both of you.
Well, sure, I'd love to see
I've always wanted to apologize.
Just have.
Sorry?
I say you just have, but Annie said she'd love to see it.
I would love to send them to you.
Thank you.
Where should I send it?
Again, I'm listed in the phone book in New York, so.
Just check your Manhattan phone book.
Exactly.
And thank you for the call. And we go to more of your calls. We go to Arthur. Morning. Arthur?
Good morning to you both.
Hi.
And, thanks for the show. And, I had a question about digital photography, but just quickly, talking about live music, I go to a lot of concerts, and it's amazing how what people used to hold up lighters, now they hold up cell phones. and you see
it is
the
amazing.
Whole audience lit up with cell phones up in the air. Everyone's taking pictures. It's astonishing. But that kind of segues into my question about digital photography. You didn't mention too much about it, although I didn't hear the very first part of the show, but I was really curious to see how it's impacted you at all, or how in your work in
this
specific, but and also just secondarily, what your feeling is or take on it is on photography in general and art photography in specific.
Well,
it's a little bit broad on the second question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, just your thoughts, I guess, on digital photography. You know, well, maybe in regards to your work.
Well, as far as digital is concerned, the book is mostly, in fact, it's all on film. But the last couple of years, I've been scanning the negatives and printing digitally, and which gives you so much more latitude. And then literally, you know, 4 months ago, I just went over to digital work in my assignment work, and I love it. I just love it. I think the crossroads where I was doing a shoot with Barack Obama on the Hill for the cover of Men's Vogue. And
just met him yesterday, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Nice man.
Oh, my God. Nice man. It's like, let's keep our fingers crossed. But he, you know, I think in the past I would have done, wanted to have done like a black and white photo essay of him on the Hill. And then I just said, you know, this is 2006. This is like Barack Obama. You know, it's like, how do you place it now? And I think that the digital look is contemporary and, you know, it can look like anything you want it to look like. And I just haven't looked back and been shooting ever since that way. And I love it. And, you know, as far as the photography, you know, the work today being produced, I think it's just better than ever. I'm a huge photography fan. You know, when I could afford to, when I finally was making a little money, I went out and bought a Cartier-Bresson picture. I collect photographs. I love photography books. I've a big photography book collection. And when I first started working, there were very few photography books published every year, and now there are so many, and it's just fantastic. It's just a great medium. I don't know. It's great work's being done. I like there's something for everyone, you know, in it.
In photography, there certainly
is.
Yeah. And I thank the caller. Here's a listener named Becky who asks, I've always been struck by the tragedy and timing of the last photo of John Lennon with Yoko Ono. Would you be so kind as to share how being the last person to photograph them and possibly see them together affected you personally? And did it shape any of the portraits you took thereafter? Mm. Also, what was their mood that day? It seemed very playful, and I have always hoped that he left us on a high note, so to speak. Thank you. Love your work.
Thank you. I had photographed John and Yoko 10 years earlier, and they were one of the first people I met who he was one of the Beatles, and he was the first person I met and who I just admired so much, and he was a huge fan, and they both treated me so so straightforward and kind and sweet. And, I found out later that they really thought that I was more like a photography student, you know, and when I went back that day in 1980 to take that picture, which was with the cover of Rolling Stone, they were just very glad to see that my work had progressed, and they were happy to see me. And they had just come out with Double Fantasy, and it was this beautiful kiss on the cover. And I wanted to emulate something like that. It's something about the romance of their lives, and hence that picture. He, you know, it was literally hours later, and he was murdered. And you know, that doesn't, something like that happens, and I was definitely thrown. I mean, the first thing that you think of is, well, what if I had met them like I said I was going to meet them at the studio and shown them the pictures? Or is there something that could have altered that timetable with what happened? And then you just want to, honestly, I just it was so much the end of an era, that whole, you know, Rolling Stone moment. You just want to do the best you can. You know, it makes you feel like you want to do the best you can.
Anna, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with us.
Hi.
Morning.
I wanted to say thank you, Annie. This morning, I rarely get the opportunity to listen to Forum anymore because I'm always at work.
Oh.
This morning, I am ironically on my way to say goodbye to my grandmother. She's 90 years old, and she's on her deathbed, and I really struggled with whether to bring my camera. And when you said what your friend said about, you know, death is just as much a part of life as birth, and you must put those photographs in, it just made me know I made the right move by not only putting my camera in the car with me, but that I do need to take more pictures of my grandmother when I'm home.
It's a great tradition, and you should feel very good about it. And
you know, there's something else.
It's important to hold on to those pictures. You may not look at them right away, but you'll look at them at some point.
I think I told you before we went on the air that my father was hospitalized and maybe on that, what Dylan Thomas called that sad height. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's day to day. But I thought about this, you know, taking pictures, particularly because when I was a young man, he said to me, his father was dying, and he said, I want you to see your grandfather because life is part of death and death is part of life, and there's no separating them. But he was also a man who had a certain modicum of vanity. And to think about pictures when he's looking as frail and as bad as he looks, I'm not sure he would have been happy with that.
Well,
you understand what I'm saying?
I do understand what you're saying. I think it's something about holding on to, you know, what's going to go.
Or the way you remembered. You want to remember people maybe when they're stronger, don't you? And the photograph is an image that brings back memory.
I think so, and I don't think you'll necessarily, you know, it may take some time before you want to look at the picture again. But I think it's, I don't think we should be afraid of that. I mean, I think that it is part of, we don't see it enough, and sickness and illness and death is a part of life, and is, you know, whether you, I understand that argument. It's a very, very good argument. It shouldn't stop you from, if you want to take a picture, though. I mean, it's something for yourself.
Let me thank Anna for her call, and we'll go to more of your calls. Fennel, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Annie. I have a few questions. I recently saw the movie Town Bloody Hall by Penda Baker, and who was one of the pioneers of cinema verite.
Sure.
And there was a. Have you seen that movie?
I actually haven't. Terrible. Okay. I don't get out very often.
Okay. It was. They had it showing in the Castro, and it was very moving. And there was a shot of Susan in the movie too.
Yeah.
And she was looking awfully young. And it was a beautiful movie. And I was wondering, if you had met Penda Baker, and what you thought of their approach.
They were on this program, by the way, about maybe 9 months ago.
Oh, well, I think it's, you know, I mean, they've done great, great work, and, you know, it's, how could I not like their approach? You know, they just go in there and, you know, don't give up, you know. It's relentless. It's just, you know, it's great. It's fantastic.
You know Fred Wiseman's work, speaking of... cinema verite, or
The hospital and the of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Susan loved his work, and we went to every single one of them.
But most of all, she loved Godard.
Yeah,
I think that's safe to say, isn't it? As far as filmmakers went. Let me thank Morgan for the call and get to. Actually, I'm sorry. This is Morgan. Good morning, Morgan.
Hello. I'm a 20-year-old photographer, and I want to say first of all that Annie, you are just a hero of mine. It's so awesome to be able to talk to you. I've been doing mainly concert photography since I was about 15, and I've had the opportunity now to photograph quite a few famous bands, but I've noticed how incredibly male-dominated the music photography industry is. It's always interesting to be the only woman up there with a whole bunch of men, and I was wondering...
Enjoy it, actually. Go for it.
Yeah, so how has that impacted you as a photographer, being a woman in the industry?
You know, I really never ever thought about it that much. I mean, you know, I think it was more that I was young doing it, and I think there was an advantage to it in some way, because I don't think anyone took me too seriously, you know, in the beginning, and I felt like it allowed me to sort of, you know, move in and do things that, you know, that were, you know, that were very good. You know, got you in closer, because no one ever thought you were going to be able to do it, I guess, or something. I think that's kind of interesting. And then, you know, it's, you know, I think it's, there's something about, if I was pressed to say what is it, you know, about being a woman, is maybe that there's more empathy involved, you know, from a woman photographer, possibly. I don't want to, you know, etch that in stone, because, you know, there's, but I think that that's true.
Thank you for the call, Morgan. Good luck in your career. And Chuck, join us. Good morning.
Thanks a lot, and good morning, everyone. I'm not making an argument by any stretch here, but I'm interested in your guest's take on taking pictures in the course of daily, everyday life, especially during some of these very significant moments in daily life, and the effect on the quality of your experience that this has, in the sense, do you feel that it removes you from the moment at all, and is that a bad thing, or can it maybe be a good thing sometimes in making certain situations easier? And
that's a good question. That's a very good question. I think that when you look through the book, you know, it's just a tiny part of my life. I mean, it's not my life. In fact, when Susan was sick in 1998. You know, she was in the hospital for about a longer than a month, and I took the month off, and it was more or less something to do. I think she was quite happy to see me taking pictures. This last time that Susan was sick, I really didn't take pictures the whole year until really the end, and I think it was almost this idea that I forced myself, you know, to take those pictures at the very end because I knew she was dying, or I had, you know, a sense of that. My father's death was so completely different. I don't know how to describe this, but it was quite beautiful. I mean, he died in my mother's arms, and his head was on this pillow that has, you know, a pillowcase that had flowers, and it was sort of as beautiful as a death could be, I think, on some level. He was in his 90s.
Your dad was an Air Force guy.
Yeah, I mean, the whole family traveled. We moved every couple of years, which is hence I think it's very similar to going out and taking pictures. I think you go meet a new person, you know, you get good at the 15-minute relationship, you know. Yeah.
But his funeral had full regalia of Air Force.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Do you feel in a way that sometimes in those situations, though, that something was lost, perhaps by?
No. I think I've been doing this for so many years. You learn how to. I'm not taking pictures all the time, and you know, when you pick the camera up, I mean, it's you know, in fact, if anything, I don't think I you never stop. You don't stop seeing. You are always seeing, and you know, and it's been something that I've been doing so long. It's like it's a trained aspect, and you know, the 35 millimeter black and white, I know like the back of my hand, and I just can pick up the camera, and it can be seamless, you know, in my life. I had to make a conscious effort midway through my career to leave the camera, you know, home sometime, you know, not use the camera. And that's, you know, hence Susan was, you know, was mad at me. Why aren't you taking more pictures? You know, I say this in the introduction. She wondered why I didn't take more pictures, and I think she was always pleased when I did have the camera. But I actually made a conscious effort to try to be there without taking pictures. And you know, now I have a fairly good sense of what I'm doing.
Let me thank Chuck for the call. I was reminded when you were talking about seeing of a wonderful line of Adrienne Rich's: "What we see, and seeing is changing." Kind of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, kind of the ethos, maybe, of the work, you know, of many photographers.
I don't know if you notice in the book, there's a grid. There are these grids of four pictures together, because as I was doing the edit from the personal work, I was looking for, you know, the decisive moment, you know, looking for these moments. And I couldn't find pictures that were like, you know, of a, you know, a heightened moment. And I just found the stream of thought, almost like notes. And just as a way to sort of edit the book quickly, you know, we were throwing like four photographs on a grid, we were scanning them and on a Xerox, you know, page, looking at four photographs at once. And as I looked at them, I said, oh, you know, this is more powerful together. I mean, I don't think I'm really good at the moment. I'm sort of like after the decisive moment, you know, especially in my portrait work, it's more of a studied moment. But anyway, it's hard to pick those pictures apart. There's a little film going on, and it feels more like life to me. And it was done more, you know, I'm not too sure it's photography, you know, but really.
Another caller I want to go to, but when you say we, who do you mean we?
We. Yeah, I'm sorry. I do, you know, that I do have a, you know, you know, problem with that. I'm usually working with like Jeff Streeper, an art director, you know, a designer friend of mine who basically held my hand through the whole thing, you know, there was always someone else there helping me get through this massive amount of material.
Robin, morning, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Sure. I have a question. I'd like to know, Annie, what gives you courage when you either have a vision or you're thinking of the composition of the picture in the face of perhaps unsupport or disapproval? I just would like to know how you continue in creating the essence and the idea of what you'd like to create.
How do you stick to your vision?
Well, I think I was very lucky in that, you know, I worked for Rolling Stone, and I worked at such a young age. I sort of grew up in this very creative atmosphere where, you know, our country was in turmoil. You know, I was working with people like Hunter Thompson and
talking
Tom
turmoil.
Wolf and talking turmoil. Yeah. But you know, there was always, you know, you're always taught, you know, and even my parents taught me this too, to always question everything, you know, that came along. And I think I just had a very good training.
I think that's going to have
field.
To be the final word.
Yeah.
We're out
okay.
of time. Annie Leibovitz.
Okay.
Pleasure to have you on here. Thank
Thanks,
you so much.
Michael.
The book is A Photographer's Life, 1990 to 2005. And once again, she'll be at this weekend's luncheon, Kidney Foundation luncheon on Saturday. The Kidney Foundation phone number is 415-543-3303. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G, and Kevin Guillory. Also, our interns, our fall interns, Elsa Chang, Barton Kreith, Nagar Gubadi, Mike Fisher, Mary Trail, and Leah Wellborn. And Annie's going to be at Cody's, too, we should mention. This is tonight. Thank you for being with us. Our executive producers, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.